The future belongs to those who control the culture, and the culture belongs to those who control the conversation. So we are having the conversations you wish you could have at church to build a safe and vibrant community. This is the Oz Table Talk Podcast. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Oz Table Talk. Now, we are super stoked because this is the first episode that we've actually been recording together since this whole COVID mess started. So, welcome back to the table, guys.
It's great to be back in person. It is a little bit strange not seeing yous all in little screens, but I am loving the change. Mm-hmm.
Probably worth mentioning that Maddie's with us.
Yeah, that's the biggest change.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just go have a little vacay.
Yeah.
Well, we missed you, mate.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's funny, you know, because I was listening to, I listened to our content, you know, as we recorded, as we edited and, or after it's released. And it's funny how different the energy is. It's not that it's good, bad, or otherwise, but how different the energy is. There's so much less energy when Matt's not here. And so it's just, yeah, so good to have you back.
Yeah. Thanks for all the just pressure.
Yeah,
with that comment. Now, if this record's flat, it's gonna be Matt just wasn't what he used to be.
I actually wish I was having a bit of a giggle to myself as I was saying it, because as I'm describing the energy that you bring,
he's yawning.
Yeah, he's yawning and reclining on the lounge, like.
I'm just saying,
this is normally my nap time. Guys.
Recording in Ben's lounge room is so much better than Seth's bedroom.
Okay? Yeah. Yes.
There's recliners. There's an air conditioning system. I've got a pillow on my lap. I'm set. Wake me up.
Yeah. Can you just stay awake at least until we finish recording? Just as there's a favour to me.
Give us 20 minutes break. Now let's kick off.
Yeah. Okay. So we decided, just as a bit of a warm up, we thought we would do a rapid fire episode. But it sounds like it's going to be slower than rapid fire, but we've got four questions that we're going to be dealing with, and the first one is, what is a surefire way to find yourself in safe friendships or connections with people? Kind of an interesting way to set up a question. So I guess let's start by talking about what that means. Why would it be looking for a safe friendship with someone?
It depends what you mean by safe, I suppose. Mm. Like, I think there's many ways you could interpret that. You know, you could be looking at that from a physical standpoint. You could be looking at it from a mental and emotional, which is probably what I'm thinking the question is intended to mean. Mm-hmm. It could also mean, like, somebody who doesn't take you out of your comfort zone, which one would have to wonder why you would want friends like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's certain, there's certainly a lot of nuance around the question, but being that we only got four questions to chew through, I think we can afford a little bit of time to extrapolate on it and maybe look at those kind of things. I think definitely from, like, say, a physical standpoint, it's extremely important that we have a safe friendship, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's basically a friendship or some sort of relationship that respects the physical boundaries that you set, regardless of the level of friendship or whatever that is. But, you know, just the ability to know that, you know, whatever boundary you put in place, it's going to be respected and upheld. So
it's probably the key word, really, isn't it? Boundaries, you know.
Yeah.
In either of the contexts.
Well, I guess in anything with the safe relationship, it's the respecting of a boundary. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
And I suppose you could say that it's not just with the physical, but with the emotional as well, because you're always going to have those the things that you're not going to do. And if you've got a friend who wants to push you over the edge, then is it really a safe relationship?
Yeah.
That being said, you're mentioning a friend who doesn't push you at the same time is bad as well, because there's a lot of things that we should be pushed on, and it's actually good and healthy for us to be pushed on those points.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the difference there is between, like, a core belief boundary and a comfort boundary.
Mm-hmm. And also maybe a healthy boundary. Like, you know, if it's a boundary that you've set up because that is what you need to be a healthy person, then, yeah, that needs to be respected. But if it's just something that makes you feel comfortable, then, get rid of it.
Yeah.
Maybe slowly to be a nice friend, but maybe not.
We all have that one friend, right?
If your friend's, you know, afraid of heights, you know, surprising them on a sky with a skydiving ticket for their birthday is probably, you know, maybe a step too far.
Yeah.
You know, maybe make them walk the bridge first. But although, you know, sometimes a friend will, you know, surprise you with a toy snake, and that's all right, isn't it?
Yeah, well, maybe next time I should have thrown you off in the middle of Mondrian Dam on that jet ski.
Just for clarity, Matt hates snakes with a passion, and there has been...
It's beyond a hate. It is a fear. It's a
phobia, right?
Yeah, it is a very primal fear there. Well, I'm sorry, bro. It's all right.
Well,
I got over it.
You should have been at my place a couple of weeks ago. There was a...
I'd rather not. I know where the story's going.
Yeah, yeah. There was a brown snake at least 2 meters long on my front door, which I wasn't very fond of. So I was glad that he was on the move, not sticking around. I was happy about that.
You got him moved on?
Actually, he was moving. So as in, like, he was near my front door, which I was on the front porch, and so I didn't like that very much. But he saw me, stopped, had a bit of a look, and then turned the other way and went across and into the neighbor's yard.
Yeah, somebody else's problem. Just the way we like it.
Nope. Sell up. Go. Boom.
Well, look, to be fair, it is. There are roadworks on the freeway on the other side of our property. The intervening... freeway.
It's a road.
Highway.
Freeway.
Road. Whatever. It's the main, it's like main
two
road.
Lanes, dude.
It's the main road into Bundy, so that qualifies, okay? But as
it's the main road into Bundy, so that qualifies it. The weakest statement I have heard. Weak.
Meanwhile, you're wasting our listeners' time.
Oh, he's wasting.
And here am I telling
stories
about snakes.
We missed you. You're wasting our time. The entry road into a town of 30,000 people is a freeway, mate. That's just manipulation and deception.
30,000, huh? You might want to double that.
We're talking permanent residence.
Can I interrupt this and take us back to the question?
I'd love it if you would.
So, I think, you know, the word safe should probably be a synonym for healthy in this sense. And so, having a healthy friend, I think we've spoken about boundaries. We've spoken about respect, which I think is probably a really big one. If you sense that there's not a respect for your boundaries in the relationship, that's probably a really good indicator.
You'll feel very uncomfortable in the relationship anyway. You won't want it to progress any deeper as a friendship if, you know... Or even into a friendship if you don't feel that they respect boundaries.
At the very least, you'll be looking at a way to avoid interaction, which is not a good sign.
No. Mm.
And ultimately, this is defining the question, but the real question was what's a surefire way to find such friendships?
Yeah. Well, I think we need to be confident in our own boundaries is the first step.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't know what our boundaries are, then, you know, there's no hard line to know where, you know, things should stop and whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's not the definition is not really going to be helpful.
Sorry.
And then there was silence.
I thought you were still going. I thought that was like a stop halfway through the thought, and I'm waiting for the next part.
No, bro.
Like, it didn't go.
That was the traffic lights at the end of the freeway.
Well, I was thinking about this, and I think there are some things that you can do, right? And I think that's a great start of you being a healthy friend in the first place. That is fair enough. And we have to acknowledge, I think, that there is going to be a degree of trial and error. You're going to have to interact with people until you find people that you feel meet the criteria. But you can look in places where you are more likely to find them. And I would say that would be a case of looking in places where you share values. You know, if that's your church or, you know, within your church sphere, like it might be events or summer camps or, you know, whatever it may be. But look for institutions with lots of other people who do share your values, and then eventually you are more likely to find people within those structures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's not to say that you can't have friends from outside those structures.
For sure.
No. You know, like certainly if we were only saying to pick your friend circle from inside the area of your beliefs, then you start filling an echo chamber very quickly, which isn't any good for our development or growth. Yeah, but
so that's probably unhealthy in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, but the other thing is, how are you going to do any sort of evangelism if you're just talking to people of your own faith as well?
Yeah, yeah, of course. But, you know, like, I think that the key thing is if you respect your boundaries and your kind of core beliefs, then you will then put a value on that that other people have to meet mm-hmm. for you to develop a friendship or a relationship with. Mm-hmm. And when you understand that valuation of your beliefs, then that gives you, a high point to kind of fall back on. Not that it's always easy, because sometimes, you know, I think innately we like to all want to have large circles of influence, large circles of friends, and, you know, sometimes holding to our beliefs is very hard to mesh with everyone mm. on that kind of basis, but it's important that definitely mm. that we kind of stick to those ideas of respect for our boundaries that enable us just our security mm-hmm. around ourselves, around our character.
Let me ask you guys this question. Have you ever intentionally thought, I need to make some friends and this is how I'm going to do it?
Not really.
No, me either. And I think we're talking about doing it in a very intentional way, like a planned way. But really speaking, none of us have ever done it that way, right?
No. Well, I don't think we're saying that you've got to be robotic about it, which is maybe what we're sounding like.
Mm.
But it's a self-development stage. If you respect what you believe, then innately you are expecting others to live up to that expectation too. And if they don't, you just don't develop. Because you've put such a high value on your belief, you just don't develop a relationship with those who don't match that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you just kind of mentally, probably even on a subconscious level, just develop another, you know, vetting process of how you're interacting with people.
Yeah.
Not to say that you don't interact with people who don't respect that, but it's just more the, you know, before you allow them in or you start, you know, valuing them as a friend or whatever, you've kind of just checked their character again.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a really important thing, because I think we can all say, you know, maybe especially while we're younger, you know, our interest in being socially accepted, in being popular, we thrive on the ability to make friends quickly
mm-hmm.
without actually valuing or seeing the value of said friendships.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes we look at our friend circles and realize that they're filled with a lot of chaff that don't bring a lot of value in themselves. Mm-hmm. So...
Because when I met all you guys, I was, you know, in my early 20s, I was exactly as you described, you know, it was more about, hey, you know, let's make friends with anybody and everybody who's around me. And I really value that. And, you know, in a sense, I'm actually really glad that I was in that mode, because now in hindsight, like, each of us are very different people, right? Like, you know, if we were to really analyze the different personalities being very different... now, you know, that's an asset, because we learn from each other, we push ourselves to be better, but ultimately that friendship that has developed, we are, you know, at least as far as from my perspective, we're all committed to each other as friends. We all know that we're different, but we're committed to the friendships, and that allows us growth, that allows us to learn from each other. And so that sort of bolsters your point from before, Matt, about saying that we shouldn't necessarily be looking for people that are the same as us. We got a lot to learn from people who are different as well. So.
Yeah. I don't know. I honestly feel like understanding your own boundaries and being really confident in that is really just the key. Because like you were just pointing out, you're going to meet people in your life. Unless you're a complete hermit, you're going to meet people. And I think if you have Christian values, you're going to befriend them. Right? I mean, that's the way it's worked for us anyway. You meet people, you become friends with them at some level.
Yeah.
And then I think over time you choose to what level that
where
remains.
You go deeper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whether you become closer and closer friends, or whether you realize this is not a healthy friend for me to go deep with.
Mm.
They're just going to remain as an acquaintance that I like, but I can't stand for a very long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Or even a friendship that sometimes like you start going deeper with and then you realize there's unhealthy expectations on it.
Mm.
And so then you've got to kind of backpedal a bit on it. And those kind of all... scenarios can be extremely awkward.
Yeah.
But if you don't backpedal on it or arrest it from going deeper, then you're going to cause a lot more pain, anxiety further down the track. And I think that might be where, perhaps maybe from where the question's being asked.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure. We didn't get all the nuances about a very open question. But, you know, I think the idea that we keep... And yeah. What do you think about that? So, like, I know we're pushing the boundaries with questions severely here, but what do you think about that? Like, when you get to that stage you were just talking about where it can get awkward if you feel like you're going to have to backpedal, do you think honesty is the best policy there, or what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think if you're approached at, like, you know, confronted by it, like, if the other party doesn't kind of... I think there's subtle ways of backpedaling,
right,
that allow both parties to save face, so to speak, you know, which is, I think, at least in a Western culture, something that we kind of value a bit more if pride's left intact and things like that, because then people aren't felt, I guess, you don't feel that injured moment. Mm. But if you're confronted by it, then, yeah, honesty has to be, you know, forefront. But let's say we were in an unhealthy friendship, Dave.
Yeah.
Okay. You and I met at, argument's sake, say we met at work, you know. We started developing a bit of a friendship. We caught up a few times, and then as we got to know each other more and more, you found out that maybe I had a really bad habit or a style of doing things that you didn't feel comfortable about. And the more and more we spent time together, the more and more that was becoming prevalent, to a point you felt uncomfortable to catch up with me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's ways that we can start backpedaling on the friendship that give us opportunity to arrest that. So, it might be ensuring that we don't just catch up, the two of us,
mm-hmm.
Without anyone else there to mm-hmm. help create like a space or a buffer. It might even just be, instead of saying yes to every catch up, you know, you got to start saying no to catch ups. And then, you know, yeah, if I come at you and say, hey, Dave, we always used to catch up. What's happening, man? What's, you know, then the honesty needs to be there. Like, you know, that you would say, like,
if you were just at that point to say, ah, no, I've just been busy, then you're actually going to really make it harder later, because then they're going to keep asking and it's going to go downhill, right?
Yeah. Well, even beyond that, if I suspect that he hasn't been busy, or I found out that he's been deceptive to me,
catching
then
up with someone else,
yeah,
then that's, you know, yeah, that's actually very disruptive too.
Yeah.
So I think I
like your thinking, because I think what you're saying is sometimes we need to, you know, use a bit of tact. Mm-hmm. But then there comes a time where you've just got to be just honest. Just,
well, I think when Jesus dealt with sinners, dealt with people, not that something that, you know, we've got an exact parable to draw a correlation to, but yeah, he was exceptionally tactful with those who weren't exactly aware of what they were doing.
Right.
But for those who were very, you know, very clearly in the wrong or needed a very honest answer, he was extremely forthcoming in that as well. And I think that's important too. And, I you know, in that same scenario, the unhealthy friendship, you know, if it was ever getting pushed to a point where you were feeling so uncomfortable, then sometimes you might have to come out with the honest answer before being prodded and just being like, you know what, man, I can't do this anymore because this is really not my vibe, you know, and I respect you, I got love for you, but like if this is what every catch-up's going to be,
mm-hmm.
I don't really want to do this that much, man.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So, like, yeah, that's...
Yeah, I agree. I think the reason I asked that question is because I think maybe that's a weakness for me, because I think I need to be more honest rather than, you know, taking the subtle approach, you know, to the point where it's just not working.
Not clear, yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes it depends on the boundary as well, I think, because sometimes the boundary is a really... It's a significant boundary, right? And it's one that you really don't want to have any compromise on. Mm-hmm. And if it's a significant boundary that's going to make, you know, things really unhealthy for you, I think you need to make a stand, you know, just right away. Just be really honest, you know, in a kind way, of course. Mm-hmm. Just be really honest and say, look, this is not healthy for me to continue doing this. I'm sorry. Yeah. Hope that doesn't offend you, but this is just the way it is for me. And I think sometimes, even though that seems a bit rude sometimes, that's really what we have to do. And I think as people, we're not good at that.
Mm.
So that's why I thought it'd be worth, you know, mentioning.
But look, it's almost what they could do, just to finish off that, is if they truly respect that boundary, that's going to grow the friendship.
Exactly.
You know, even though it's an awkward scenario.
Yeah.
But like, you know, if you said to me, hey, Matt, look, I don't want to watch the footy every time I'm around with you because, you know, I don't like it or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and then I go, well, actually, I can respect that. I understand that.
Yeah.
Well, how about we just stop watching every time we catch up.
Yeah.
Let's do something else that you feel more comfortable doing. Yeah. You know, because then that gives an opportunity for the relationship to grow. And that you know, we've tried to use, I think, as much vanilla language that you can extrapolate that onto other scenarios. It might even be an unwelcome romantic advance, you know, which is can be an exceptionally awkward scenario. Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, if they respect you and your boundaries... Mm. Then they're going to respect what you have to say.
And if they don't respect your boundaries, that's a good sign that you made the right choice.
That is the biggest red flag you can come across.
Yeah.
If they don't want to respect your boundaries and it's got a romantic intent,
mm-hmm.
I mean, wave that red flag and just catch you later, Felicia. I'm done. Right?
Yeah.
Just saying. Like, yeah, without trying to...
Mm.
Yeah. But we've chewed the fat on that question. Unless we've got anything.
Really have, hey. We're 20 minutes.
It was a really good question, actually.
It was.
And we used a lot of... We explored a lot of nuance in that.
So. Yeah. So, let's grab another one. So, we might deal with this one even faster. How about that?
Oh, I don't know. I know what the second question is.
So, this one came from Marion. So, thanks for this, Marion. We have heard quite a bit from you lately, and we're really grateful because a lot of the questions that you have been really interesting. For those regular listeners, probably have noticed a few of our episodes have been focused around questions that Marion has sent. So, here's another one. If Satan wanted to ask forgiveness, could he?
Yes, I believe Christ would give him a way to be forgiven and to remove his sins.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he wants to or not is another matter.
Do you believe that, like, right... Because this event, this kind of goes into a question of could Satan still be saved,
uh-huh.
I think, to a degree. Because if he can be forgiven and have his sin expunged, then that should be the biggest opening point for reconciliation with God. And of course, there's a lot of that. Does he have a desire to be? That's not being accounted for. But just on the you know, the pure semantics of... could it? I don't know, man. Like, this is such a hard question. It challenges the whole, I think, the whole structure of the cosmos.
Man. Maybe ask you the question a different way to start with. So, is God capable of forgiving Satan?
I think so. He has to be.
Yeah.
He's love. He's all-encompassing.
Right. Mm-hmm. In fact, you would have to say that from the beginning, when Satan first sinned, that was God's plan A.
Mm-hmm.
Right? To extend forgiveness to him, to restore him to his original position, and for everything to be swell again.
Yeah, I mean, biblically, I'd have to find the verses, but it said that half of heaven actually sided with Satan initially, but only one third of the angels actually fell with him. So there were some angels that originally sided with him and then went, oh, that's a really bad idea.
Right.
Hmm.
I feel like that might be extra biblical, but if you can find the Bible verses, I'd be interested.
Yeah.
One
thing that, I mean, my perspective on this is totally affirm what you were pointing out, that Dave, that the could God do it? Like, is God big enough to do it? Absolutely. We know that his mercy is beyond measure, but I think the variable is Satan himself, and I would think that if the way I read scripture is correct, that at the point of the cross, I would have said that, I don't know if it was, but I would say at the very least that was the point of no return.
Mm. That's what I feel like I've been raised believing, but I can't say where that belief comes from. But I was always kind of brought up, and I like I said, this is an extremely flimsy thing to prove, like, because I can't find where that backed up, but I was always kind of said that up until like that cross moment, there was every chance for reconciliation with God.
Mm-hmm.
But once at the cross, that was a Rubicon moment.
Mm-hmm. I think that comes from the fact that we believe that there's this, you know, big picture, great controversy going on between, you know, good and evil, Christ and Satan in the universe. And that was that ultimate moment where God showed himself for who he was to, like, the nth degree.
Mm. And also showed Satan for who he was, right?
Well, yeah, I guess as a matter of contrast, yes.
Yeah.
But more importantly, God showed what the truth was. Mm. And at that point, there was really no return for Satan because he had, you know, gone, you know, peddled this lie and peddled and peddled and peddled it all the way through history to that point. And then in the face of Jesus, you know, dying, saying, you know, Father, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing, mm-hmm. On the cross, he's still like, see? Like, it doesn't make any sense. So I think that's where that belief comes from, you know, what you were just describing that, because I was brought up believing similar. I think there's a lot of, you know, maybe factual truth in that, that was the moment when, you know, Satan's rights, if you like, to heaven were then removed.
Sealed away, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, he was no longer, you know, permitted to you know, just gallivant around the universe like he once could. Mm. But, yeah, I think just maybe more specific to the question, I think maybe the question we need to ask ourselves is, what do we believe about the unpardonable sin? Because I think understanding the unpardonable sin would help us to understand the answer to Marion's question.
Yeah.
And I think the answer to the unpardonable sin is that you've only ever committed the unpardonable sin if you're not willing to repent, right? Mm-hmm. And that is sealed by death, mm-hmm. right? So right up until the moment when you die, you still have the capacity to ask God for forgiveness and, you know, genuinely to be repentant and to be forgiven, mm-hmm. right? And so the question that arises in our minds then, of course, is, well, Satan's not dead. Mm-hmm. So is it possible somehow that he has committed this unpardonable sin and yet is still alive? Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a philosophy that says yes, mm-hmm. that is possible. But I think it's almost dangerous ground to stand on at the same time as... Mm. I probably would believe that. But I still think it's almost dangerous ground to stand upon, because then that blurs the lines of the unpardonable sin for me. Mm. You know? And it makes me then question, is it possible that I could have also committed this unpardonable sin, mm. which God would not forgive, like, now? And I don't believe that, right?
I do think his station... I think there's a missing piece of the puzzle in what you were just saying there, Dave. And I think that missing piece of the puzzle is the degree of revelation that Satan received prior to the fall.
Mm.
His closeness to God, his station in the... like, as an angel, he had access to God and an understanding of God that we as humans don't have. And so I think because he has seen and been exposed to God to that level or that degree, I think that rules would apply to him that don't necessarily apply to us.
Right.
Even though God is a static, right? God is the universal standard, and the way he treats all beings the same, yes, but the beings themselves are different. And just like you and I will be graded on a curve depending on what our experience are and how much light we've received, I think that Satan will be graded harsher, mm-hmm. and receive, you know, greater condemnation because his revelation was greater than ours.
Mm-hmm. Well, seems like a fair call to me.
Yeah, but look at it this way. Satan is still a child of God, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if he could somehow turn around, repent of his ways, and was actually safe to make a member of heaven again, do you not think that God would jump on that opportunity?
Oh, he absolutely would. And mm. and the other question is Jesus enough for Satan? And the answer to that is absolutely yes, right? Mm-hmm. The forgiveness that was extended through Christ was for all. Mm. So technically, Satan is forgiven, right? Mm. In that sense, he's justified. Everyone is because of the death of Jesus. However, those who don't receive that justification as their own are exactly. still going to have to bear the sins themselves, right? That Jesus has already borne for them.
And we have the benefit of prophetic hindsight, even though it hasn't happened yet, but we have the benefit of prophecy to be able to see that we know that Satan will be destroyed. He will bear the punishment of those sins, the consequences of those sins, and therefore we know that he never repents, yeah. right? Because we have the, as I say, prophetic hindsight.
Yeah,
and can I just hypothesize as to why that might be?
Mm.
You know how when you commit an action over and over again, it becomes a habit, right? Mm. And then that habit, you know, rewires the pathways in your brain, mm-hmm. and now you are rewired to be that person, no longer the person that you were, right? Yep. And so you do those sorts of things over and over again in your lifetime, and you either move forward, as in you grow, mm-hmm. or you digress in the direction of your morality.
Mm-hmm.
I think Satan, for thousands and thousands of years has been making choices that have been concreting into his neuro pathways a path of resistance to God, so much so that I think he has convinced himself that what he is peddling is absolutely factual, right? That God is unjust. And he believes that with all of his heart. I think he had to have stood there and seen Jesus dying on the cross and not been repentant at that moment. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think he has rewired his brain so much so that he will never ask for forgiveness for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
But the question I think, you know, behind it all again is, if that were not the case, if it was possible that that could be changed, and like you said, Ben, that he would be, you know, become a happy member of the heavenly family again, God, I think God would take him back in a moment.
Yeah.
I think it's just literally that whatever you call it, psychological rewiring that's happened to him that has just unfitted him choice. For heaven eternally.
Yeah.
I would actually build on that and say that often when people change the way they believe, it's some great revelation. Satan, out of all of creation, wouldn't he have one of the originally one of the best pictures of God?
Yeah.
He's got all the information and everything else. What information could God give him that he already doesn't have? And yet, he's gone down the path that you mentioned, Dave, of convincing himself that despite having this information, that God is ultimately unfair and evil.
Yeah.
That's the very argument that Paul makes in Hebrews, right? Yeah. You know, that there, God has already done everything that could possibly be done, and if that's not enough to convince you that he loves you, he can't change that. So.
Yeah.
All right, so just so we don't run too long, let's hit the next question real fast, and we'll just go bang, 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 give our answers, and then we'll jump on to the very last one.
Sounds idyllic.
Let's see if we can do it. This one is a question from Diego. So, thank you, Diego. What is your favorite favorite part of Sabbath?
The beginning.
Friday night.
Just entering Sabbath. It's such a good feeling for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've had a really busy week. You know, you can just leave all those stresses behind and enter into the Sabbath knowing that, you know, you've got a day off.
Yep.
And not that that's exactly how my Sabbath starts every week, but when it does, it's the best way to start. So, for me, I think probably the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
I like the community aspect. I could be smart and say lunch. because of my food. But no, I like the fact that there's a community catching up with people. And I love the sense of community that there is on Sabbath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, I'm with you on that. It's the fellowship. As somebody who works from home, I don't get a lot of community, so to speak, through the week. And so that fellowship, meeting together with people, really floats my boat. Or what we're doing right now, this is the ideal Sabbath afternoon.
Amen.
So, yeah.
Wilsey, your favorite part?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just kind of here.
Afternoon kip or?
No, I'm just hearing you guys kind of describe it. Not like I'm just really resonating what you had to say, Dave. It's a nice feeling, you know, when you've come off like an anxious or a very stressful week.
Mm.
Nothing beats that relief of surrendering.
Yeah, just putting it all down.
You know, like, regardless if you know that Sunday you got to pick the burden again, it's nice to shed that weight for 24 hours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's hard sometimes not to pick it back up again during the Sabbath.
Oh, yeah.
But once you've got through that 24-hour period,
then it's hard to pick it up.
No, I was going to say, you immediately know why God gave the command, right?
No,
you get that sense of, man, I appreciated that rest.
Yeah. Mm. Now, I'm going to double down on that. I'm going to say that because, I've been struggling with surrendering things lately.
Mm.
So, I'm going to double down and say that is the better part of Sabbath, is being able to surrender.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
You know? Yeah.
God was so ingenious in his plan.
Mm. Final question. If you could pick anyone from history, so let's say anybody that's currently dead, who would you have dinner with? Could be a Bible character or a historic figure, or you can pick two if you're feeling a game.
I'm actually going to say Melanchthon this time.
Oh,
he was such a great thinker, but at the same time, he had to calm down Martin Luther half the time, and I just
that's enough to give anyone an ulcer.
Sorry,
that's enough to give anyone an ulcer.
Yeah. He'd have some really interesting stories.
I'm going to need some time on this one, so you guys fire away.
All right. Wilsey, you got anything ready to roll?
I mean, there's so many. Being that I've always loved that kind of militaristic history point of view, there are so many great generals.
Mm.
I would love to just see how their mind works,
mm-hmm.
just to be able to see where that what that leadership looks mm-hmm. like, that inspired people, you know.
Yep.
So even like someone like Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar, even though they're not people, I guess, moralistically, I don't aspire to, you know, but they single-handedly could motivate, you know, tens of thousands of people to enact a will that dominated a globe.
Yeah.
You know, that's impressive. But at the same time, I would love to have sat down and have a meal with like a real humble humanitarian like Mother Teresa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to see what like what makes her sacrifice that every day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll put Julius Caesar on one side and Mother Teresa on the other.
That'd be a meal and a half.
Yeah, I was going to say, what a dinner party.
Yeah, right. One was responsible for like the genocide of the entire Celtic nation.
Yeah.
And you've the other's got picking up the pieces.
And then you got Mother Teresa who just... Or even like Florence Nightingale who was, you know, just responsible for the healing of so many broken bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nice. I would say for me... On one side of the table, I would have C.S. Lewis.
Yep. Okay. Yep.
I think that would be...
That's an interesting one.
Yeah. I think that would be a very interesting conversation to have just because I have so much appreciation. Because he... So many arguments for Christianity that we consider to be amazing ideas that are a part of the structure, I guess, of a Christian worldview now, he was pioneering those ideas. And so I would love to get a grasp of where that came from. What were the antecedent thoughts and how did he get to the place of being C.S. Lewis, you know? And on the other side of the table, reaching further back into history, I would probably say somebody like... maybe Paul or someone like one of the like the early church leaders. And I was sort of like trying to toss up which one I would pick. I don't really care which one, but someone like from the Book of Acts who saw all of those things take place and saw that rapid rise in the church. Because I'd love to, one, hear their story, but I would like to see from their perspective what they considered to be the important pieces of the puzzle. You know, because we can look back at it and say, oh, well, this is what they did and this is what they did. But... ultimately, if you're not there, you don't have the same understanding of what went on. And so, I just like to try to understand that better so we can apply it better, I guess. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was going to go with Mother Teresa, actually. Yeah. Which, sorry, Dave. So, I was like, oh, man.
Well, he picked two. Just take her.
No. But
kidnap her.
But I was thinking about it further. And so, for the humanitarian reason, you know, because that's something that's probably a passion of mine and it'd be great to learn from. You know, one of the best. But also, I read a book a couple of years ago about a missionary to South America. The way that he interacted with the jungle tribes and shared the gospel with them was really, really inspiring. So, yeah, I wouldn't mind meeting him as well.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be really cool. Who was
that, sorry?
I'm just trying to think of the name, actually. I can't think of it right now.
Not the jungle doctor.
No. But yeah, for the same reason that you were talking about, you know, just sitting down and just hearing stories, you know, of people blessed
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing. And maybe also just being able to reflect back to them the changes that have flowed on from their ministry in the past as well.
Nice. Yeah. Well, you know what I reckon? If we call it quits now, we could call this episode a 4 in 40.
4 in 40.
So, sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, whatever.
All right, well, thank you guys for submitting the questions. We always enjoy these episodes. And if you have any more that you want to hear us chat about on the next one of these kind of episodes that we do, that's great. If not, we will catch you guys next week.
We're seriously going to have to stop calling these rapid fire. Yeah.
And that's the end of another episode. Just before I head off, I want to encourage you to go over to our page on Facebook and also our account on Instagram and follow us there, because that is where we interact with our listeners, and we would love for you to enter in and join the conversation. Also, while you're signing up, I would also recommend signing up to our mailing list on our website, oztabletalk.com.au. If you do that, you will receive our exclusive content, because occasionally we do release exclusives and they only go out to our mailing list. So I would strongly recommend you go and sign up for that. If you have a few more minutes to be one of the most amazing listeners on the planet, you can go over to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review, because reviews help us to grow and they help other people to find us. So if you want to help us reach those goals, please jump in and give us a review. The final message that I'd like to leave you with is to let you know about our Patreon account. Now, Patreon is a way for creators to get paid for creating, and ultimately what we do does cost money to get us hosted and have the services that we need to run the podcast. And so if you'd like to help us do that, jump over onto patreon.com/oztabletalk, and you can give anything from even a dollar a month upwards. But at different levels, there are different benefits, different rewards that we want to give you just to say thank you for being an amazing supporter of ours. If you can't afford that, we would just gratefully accept your prayers, because that is what our ministry runs on. And so with that, I will leave you to your day, and thank you so much for listening to this episode. We look forward to seeing you guys next week.